Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm editor Candace Keener, joined by staff writer Jane McGrath.
Hey there, Candace.
Hey, Jane, you sound a little bit sniffly over there.
Yeah, I kind of have a cold. I think I got it from Josh Clark.
What a bully.
Yeah.
Well, today we're actually going to take up a topic that a lot of our listeners have emailed us about. We get a lot of requests for podcasts about the Civil War, and we're certainly no Ken Burns, and we're certainly not ambitious enough to try to tackle the entire Civil War in a single podcast. So we thought we might approach this in segments, and so today we're starting with what is, I think, pretty indisputably one of the most famous battles of the Civil War, and that's Gettysburg.
Yeah, we have a great article on the site that goes into really good detail about what happened during the battle we're going to go over. And if you have the chance to be near a computer and look at the great visuals, that'll help you a lot on when we talk about different parts of the battle.
Formations and lines and
right.
Numbers of men and strategies especially. So what's interesting about the Battle of Gettysburg is that it occurred not early on, but maybe toward the middle of the Civil War. It ranged from July 1st to 3rd, 1863. And even though there were still 2 more years of war after Gettysburg, this was considered a major turning point. Because until now, the South had been waging some major victories. And if you look at the motivation of the Confederates and the Union, you can see that the Confederates had a lot on the line. You know, for one, slavery was the South's institution, and they were fighting to preserve it. And furthermore, a lot of the fighting had been taking place on Southern soil, and so these men were fighting to protect their land, their homes, their families. They had a lot at stake. Meanwhile, many men from the North, while a lot had abolitionist causes at heart, weren't as committed to fighting in the war. They'd been tapped for service by Lincoln. They were obligated to fight, but it was a war that they weren't as wholeheartedly invested in.
Yeah, you can see that they weren't as excited about it as, like, you know, the thrill of the South that the South had. But that's a good point. But also the idea that much of the North people, you know, civilians, hadn't seen much action in their own land, their own state. And this is a real change from that. This battle took place in Pennsylvania. Lee, the the Confederate general, obviously, was trying to invade the North. Ultimately, he wanted to take over Washington. By forging into the North in this campaign, he was trying to also get European support and just recognition, because they were struggling to get recognition. They were secretly trading with the British at this time, when the South was, but obviously the European powers didn't want to officially take a claim, because, you know, this was an internal conflict with the United States. They didn't want to take a side quite yet. Also, we talked in a podcast earlier about the Emancipation Proclamation, and when that was finally instituted, that's finally when the European powers wanted to step away from support for the South and say, like, they don't want to support slavery necessarily. So a lot of is at stake at this point, trying to get European support. To give you some context, Gettysburg is a small town in Pennsylvania. It only had a population of about 2,400 at the time. But it was also really important because about 10 roads intersected in the middle of this town. And it was a major stop for, like, traders and just, like, people going from, like, Harrisburg in Pennsylvania to the capital of Washington. And it was a bustling place in that way. And that's kind of what brought the two forces, the South and the North, together at that point, because while Lee was in enemy territory in the North, he was having trouble clothing and just supporting, feeding his troops. He didn't have the supply lines that he had back in the South. And so they were actually, some troops were suffering from, they needed more shoes. One Southern general, Major General A.P. Hill, actually heard that there were shoes in Gettysburg that he could take for his men, and that's why he started heading that way.
Precisely. So what you're alluding to, Jane, is the fact that Gettysburg was an unplanned battle.
Right.
No one planned to arrive in Gettysburg simultaneously.
Yeah,
and,
no one
and
really
fight.
Knew which where the other one was. The North and South didn't know exactly where they were situated at this point, so they sort of stumbled upon each other at Gettysburg.
And I think that this battle at Gettysburg was sort of symptomatic of the happenstance circumstances of the Civil War. In the beginning, people thought that the war would be over after a few major decisive battles, and that certainly was not the case. It turned into a war of attrition in which each side was trying to wear the other down, and these massive death tolls were being incurred. And as we'll see, Gettysburg was no exception to that. So here we have a couple of Confederate troops rolling into Gettysburg looking for shoes, and coincidentally, there are Union troops already there. And so we'll see that the South, who'd been so victorious so far, their men had a lot of valor and guts and courage and maybe a little bit too much arrogance. You know, they were men from West Point and the Virginia Military Institute. We'll see that this sort of cockiness paved the way for defeat.
Yeah, and especially they were coming off of a win at the Battle of Chancellorsville. The South had a lot of confidence after that, even though we should note that at that battle, Stonewall Jackson, the great Southern leader, was killed accidentally by friendly fire. He was a major liability. And like you mentioned, if it was to become a war of attrition, that sort of put the Confederates at a disadvantage because they had less men in general.
Precisely.
And that was certainly the case at Gettysburg. They were outmanned by the North. One major point of we should mention about Gettysburg is that Lee actually came into conflict at butting heads with his subordinate Longstreet.
So we have Robert E. Lee and James Longstreet, and Lee is very much a fan of aggressive war tactics,
mm-hmm.
whereas James Longstreet prefers defensive tactics. And even though offensive tactics had won the Confederacy Chancellorsville, it had also cost them nearly 12,000 men. And like Jane was saying, if this was a game of numbers, the South simply couldn't afford to take another huge loss like that. And so there are plenty of historians and theorists out there who like to say that this conflict in ideology between Longstreet and Lee is what ultimately cost the South Gettysburg.
Right, because some people say Longstreet was sort of reluctant and slow to listen to Lee, and so he didn't act as quickly as he should have.
And if you see that portrayed in the movie Gettysburg, you see that Longstreet is made out to be a more contemplative, heroic figure, but there are other historians who would argue that it bordered insubordination because he would sometimes refuse to carry out Lee's orders, or he would carry them out so slowly that they were rendered ineffective.
Mm-hmm. Sort of play devil's advocate for Lee, at least. he knew at this point that Meade, the Union general at this point, that Meade had never really won a major battle. Mm-hmm. And that also the North had to replace a lot of their seasoned soldiers at that time with inexperienced men. So Lee just sort of felt like also, like we mentioned before, coming off like the confidence of the win at Chancellorsville and all these things going with him, he had that confidence that he thought he could just take the offensive and it would work out.
He did. And let's not forget that the major initiative here was that he was on his way to Washington. He was going to take Washington. He was going to get Europe's recognition of the South, and it was going to be a major coup. Mm-hmm. And so you can see how this sort of enthusiasm wound up costing him way too many lives. So we know that the battle lasted for 3 days. So before we delve into the instances that occurred on each particular day of the battle, here are the highlights. Day one is officially July 1st, 1863, and this is when the troops from both sides roll into town. They've already encountered, you know, they've done their reconnaissance. They know that either side is there, so they know that they're going to be waging a battle. And in Gettysburg, the Confederates actually push the Union troops out of the town and to the hills outside of town. And this turned out to be a really bad move because in war, you want the vantage point of a hill because you have the elevation from which to fight and also to scope out what's going on the other side.
Right. You can see the enemy more easily.
Exactly. So by day two, which is July 2nd, Lee has a very ill-fated maneuver that he tries where he attacks the Union from the left side, hoping that the right side of the flank will dash over there and help save the guys, and then he's going to have someone else attack them to the right, and then the left will have to rush to the right's rescue, and essentially both sides would crumble, but this attack failed. So on day three, July 3rd, he tries a different tactic, and that is attacking from the center, which also fails.
Right.
So,
to go back, the day before conflict actually started, you have this Union Major General, John Buford, who had arrived in Gettysburg, and he had two brigades of cavalry with him, and he spotted Confederates actually from the top of a Lutheran seminary there. Buford then sent word to Major General John Reynolds, who was about 6 miles away at this point, who himself sent for reinforcements from Union General George Meade, who was 6 miles farther from him at Tawnytown, Maryland.
So on dawn, on July 1st, this is when Buford officially begins fighting with the Confederate Major General Henry Heth. And he had actually been sent to Gettysburg to procure these infamous shoes. And by 8:30, the Union was already struggling that day. By noon, they were completely pushed out of town and shoved off toward the hills.
Right, and these hills, we should mention, were in the south of town. And the Confederates actually tried to push further, like they wanted to get the North past these good vantage point of the hills, but they're held back by the Iron Brigade, which consisted of about 1,800 men, but in the Iron Brigade actually lost 1,200, or at least through casualties that day, but they were still able to withhold and keep their ground on these hills.
And what's important, while they were doing that and holding the Confederates back, there were Union troops mobilizing by Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill, and the Confederates didn't know how many men were being prepared to fight.
So by afternoon, you have Confederate Heth attacking the southern end of the Union flank and Major General Robert E. Rhodes attacking the northern end. By the end, some people argue that the Confederate Lieutenant General Ewell was actually, he didn't push hard enough because he was ordered by Lee to push the north past the hills, but he actually instead, he tried, but he failed at first, and he wanted to wait until Longstreet arrived that night. Historians argue that he didn't try hard enough, and this was a major mistake that probably ultimately cost the battle.
And I think at this point, too, Longstreet actually wanted to maneuver the troops around so they could get toward Washington.
Right, when he finally arrived that night, and that was the end of day one.
Right, Lee was the one who held on, and perhaps Lee was looking around, and he'd gotten word of some numbers, and he got a little bit cocky because the Confederates actually lost 8,000 men that day, and the Union had lost 9,000.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention what Lee knew and what he didn't. One important point that we forgot to mention earlier was that Lee was out of contact with his cavalrymen, which were basically his eyes and his ears, and they were led by J.E.B. Stuart. And this was a major disadvantage for the South at this point. Usually during battle, that's a huge advantage to be able to know where your enemy is and everything like that. And so what Lee didn't know hurt him. So like we said, General Longstreet arrived that night at the end of day one. He argued with Lee about what to do. He wanted to take a more defensive position. And then at the beginning of day two, which was July 2nd, the rest of the Union Army came to reinforce their troops. And the Union sort of positioned themselves in the shape of a fishhook at this point, curving, this is when visuals will help you at this point, curving around Culp's Hill, snaking around Cemetery Hill, down Cemetery Ridge to the hills of Little Round Top and Round Top, which were hills. And the Confederates were sort of in a long, thin, concave line. Longstreet and Ewell were on the flanks, either side, and Hill was in the center. Lee actually ordered Ewell to attack the Union right around Cemetery and Culp's Hill, and Longstreet to attack Union left. But unfortunately, both of these attacks were delayed at this point for various reasons, and Longstreet and his counterpart were not able to attack till late afternoon that day.
So at this point, the Union commander, Daniel Sickles, actually takes his troops and moves them down into Peach Orchard and then toward Wheatfield and Devil's Den.
And Longstreet wasn't really expecting him then.
No.
Right.
And that's why these are such notorious battles, because they were so bloody and so violent and so many deaths incurred through here. And essentially what they were kind of fighting for at this point was Little Round Top, because this is where elevation comes back into play. This is such a pivotal point where you can watch the movement down below. You can see what the other side is doing. So Colonel Chamberlain actually wanted to defend his Union troops' place on top of Little Round Top so that the Confederates couldn't get to it. And he stood his ground for 2 hours with the Confederates just firing away at them. And he eventually lost a third of his men before he commanded a very famous bayonet charge to take out the Confederates.
And it sort of saved the Union flank at that point. Mm-hmm. It was very successful. So actually, by the end of the day two, both sides lost about 9,000 men. It was about equal, but certainly bloody. So that brings us to day three, July 3rd. Before dawn, actually, the Union actually took back ground that they had lost the day before around Culp's Hill. And this immediately foiled Lee's hopes of attacking the right flank of the Union.
Right. So he's thinking that he's going to attack the center. And Longstreet, again, a very common theme, is disagreeing with him and saying, no, I don't think that this is going to work. And in fact, it did not. So a major point of contention between Longstreet and Lee was that in order to get to the men on Culp's Hill, they're going to have to march through about 3/4 of a mile of an open field. And so the Confederates down below were just in wide open expanses, you know, perfectly positioned to be shot at from the Union troops who had the position on an elevated plain.
Yeah, so you can understand why Longstreet objected to this plan, but Lee argued that the Union was weakened. He thought that the Union didn't have much left in them.
And
but
guess who? Yeah, and guess who comes along at this point? He's been missing out on all the action. The Confederate Major General George Pickett.
Yeah, he really jumped on the chance because he'd missed. Like you said, he had missed a lot of the action beforehand. He wanted to prove himself at this point. And we should mention that Pickett wasn't the only. Like, he had his brigade, but he wasn't the only one who had men there, but his men led the charge, and so that's why it's referred to as Pickett's charge.
Which was comprised of 15,000 men, like Jane said, 5,000 of whom were actually Pickett's men, and 10,000 who technically belonged to Longstreet. So, again, Longstreet really opposes this idea of the Confederate soldiers rushing towards Cemetery Ridge, but Pickett insists, and so he leads the charge. And what's really tricky at this point is that the Union soldiers have been firing from their elevated point, and then they decide that they're going to pull the wool over the Confederates' eyes. So they stop firing entirely to trick the Confederates into thinking that they've run out of ammunition. And so this gives the Confederates an even falser sense of confidence as they continue to push forward.
So they're sort of walking into a trap at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah, and Longstreet ordered Pickett's charge ultimately around 3 p.m., didn't end up very well. 15,000 men, Confederate men, went up against about 10,000 Union infantrymen. But of course, even though the Confederate had more men at this point, at this little skirmish, the Union, as we mentioned, has the upper hand by the ground, the higher ground. And so it ultimately failed for the Confederates. They lost about half of their men in the attack, and all 13 colonels. Actually, one Confederate brigade led by Brigadier General Lewis Armistead actually made it to the top of the ridge. He was actually shot down soon after reaching the top, but it was about this point where we know as the the high watermark of the Confederacy. And this sort of, it doesn't necessarily recognize the farthest north that the Confederates literally got, but because obviously they're fighting towards the south at this point, right, just in terms of the terrain of Gettysburg. But it does, it's very symbolic in that it's the sort of the best chance they had for the northern invasion. Like we said, they got to that point, but they weren't able to hold it, and that was sort of the last ditch effort for the Confederates at that point.
So it became pretty apparent now that the battle was over and that the Confederates had lost, and those who could slunk back to their troops. Some just died in the middle of this field, and they retreated. All the troops that were still able to be mobilized retreated. And some numbers for you, just to put this in perspective, out of 88,000 Union troops, 23,000 were wounded or killed. And that was 26.1% of the Union's forces. By contrast, 75,000 Confederate troops, 28,000 wounded or killed, for a total percentage of 37.3% of Confederate men.
So Southern obviously took the harder hit in the Gettysburg.
And a war of attrition, you really can't afford to lose numbers like that.
Exactly.
So the Confederates went back to Virginia, and they didn't venture back into the North again, and Washington was essentially saved. And Lincoln was very upset with General Meade for not essentially finishing off the Confederate troops.
Yeah, Lee was actually expecting an attack after when he was retreating, and that never came. And a lot of people criticized Meade for not taking that opportunity to sort of, you know, to put it not very nicely, but to kick them when they're down. Like,
exactly.
This was a perfect opportunity to sort of just clinch it.
And we're not quite sure why. Historians speculate that the troops were so physically exhausted by this point, and so many men were down, that Meade couldn't gather enough men to kick him when he was down.
Right, right.
But it would have been ideal, and Lincoln was actually so infuriated that he fired Meade.
Mm-hmm.
And so Meade actually gave the Confederates a chance to scrape themselves up, dust themselves off, and regroup.
Yeah, and the North, or the South, actually, were able to win a couple more battles before the end of the war. I mean, you probably know this wasn't the end of the war. The war would go on for another 2 years, even though this was a major turning point, obviously. One thing you might be asking is, like, one of the most famous Union generals at this point was Ulysses S. Grant. And so why wasn't he here? Why haven't we mentioned his name? And that's because he was fighting another battle at this point, a very important battle named Vicksburg. And this was very long as well. It lasted for months, and finally it ended on the day after Gettysburg ended, July 4th, 1863, after a 47-day siege on that town. It was a Union victory. Grant came out ahead, and this was very important because it reclaimed the Mississippi River for the North, and this was a vital trade route. And also, in addition to that, it split the South in two, which made connections and reinforcements difficult between the South at that point. Grant was actually one of the reasons, probably the reason the North won the war, because of his strategy of just using the numbers against the South. He was willing to throw the numbers and play the numbers against the South, and even if it meant more casualties, it ultimately resulted in victory.
So hopefully in a future podcast, more on Grant later, and we can delve more deeply into Vicksburg. And just to wrap up the Battle of Gettysburg, in this place where no one expected to fight, you may be wondering, well, how many civilians were killed in the bloodbath? And the answer is one. And I hesitate to say just one. I already made the mistake of saying earlier, only 8,000. Any death in war is obviously a tragedy. And a young woman, about 20 years old, her name was Jenny Wade. She was at her sister's house baking bread, and she was hit by two rogue bullets while she was inside.
Aww.
So how about that?
Yeah, that's
very
sad.
Unfortunate coincidence, yeah. Getting caught in the crossfire there. And I actually blogged about the unknown soldier of Gettysburg, maybe just one of many unknown soldiers of Gettysburg, a couple of weeks ago on the Stuff You Missed in History Class blog. And if you missed that, the entry pertained to a five-part series in the New York Times by Errol Morris, who was writing about an ambrotype that had been found in a dead soldier's hand. And he had no identification on him, just this old-timey picture of three children. And so the story of tracing down his identity and the idea of just being able to put a name and a life to one dead soldier in a field of thousands of dead soldiers was a really touching story. So We actually blog about many more topics than just the Civil War on our blog. Everything from talking like Shakespeare Day to the latest news and the Great Wall of China excavation. So
that's right. And we also address some of your questions directly on Mondays now.
We do. And every Friday we do a little recap of our podcast. So we certainly hope that you will visit the blogs at howstuffworks.com. And also, if you think of any topics you'd like to hear about or have any comments or feedback for Jane and me, be sure to email us at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.